And what I believe happened is I slept with Jan Cornell and Leanne Deller, and they were just too much of a pig not to wash their sheets.
The Cape Coral Courtyard condominiums in Cape Coral, Florida, comprise of one- and two-story wood-paneled townhouses. They're nestled at the end of a winding road and are shaded under large trees, just west of Fiskaya Parkway. Madeline Munch was fast asleep in her condominium on the 10th of May 1990, when she was awoken by deafening screams coming from next door. Those screams were followed by tearful pleas of, "My baby, my baby. The fucking neighbours, why didn't they wake up?" In September of 1989, Jan Cornell and her 11-year-old daughter, Robin, relocated to Cape Coral, Florida, settling into the Cape Coral Courtyard's condominiums on 12 Avenue. Robin was enrolled at Tropic Isles Elementary School, where she quickly made a close-knit group of friends. Sharon M. Brenner, the principal of Tropic Isles, recalled of her. She was a happy, neat little girl. She made good grades. While at school, Robin displayed both her mischievous side and a caring nature. She participated in the safety patrol and maintained excellent grades. Despite her soft-spoken nature, she loved to joke around with her friends. She also had a particular fondness for nature, which was fitting for a place like Cape Coral. Her friends often saw her as the joker of the group. She and her best friend, April Waters, had a reputation for pulling playful pranks, such as putting rocks in water fountains to surprise unsuspecting drinkers. Robin's compassion for animals was evident in her kind treatment of them. She would even go the extra mile to care for injured creatures. On one occasion, she buried a dead lizard and adorned its grave with flowers. On another occasion, she nursed a baby bird back to health before releasing it back into the wild. At the same time, Jan, Robin's mother, worked as a lab technician for outpatient services at Cape Coral Hospital, affiliated with the West Coast Health Foundation. Here, she formed a close friendship with Lisa Story, a 32-year-old secretary known for her love of animals and outdoor activities. Lisa, too, was deeply upset when she accidentally hit a baby owl with her car. Donna and Kenneth, Lisa's parents, described her as outgoing and full of life, and she enjoyed long walks. Donna recollected, "She liked to go down to the Thousand Isles fishing. She liked nature. She liked those little baby oils they have in Cape Coral." Lisa was also engaged to a man named Randy Richards, a contractor in Naples. He fondly recalled of Lisa,
"She was a very outgoing person, vivacious personality, very caring, compassionate, a lot of fun to be around. She was just a good old all-American girl, hard worker."
On the 6th of May 1990, Lisa moved into Jan and Robin's two-story rented townhouse in Cape Coral. The arrangement was beneficial for both parties, as Lisa could assist with babysitting Robin when Jan needed help balancing her full-time job with single motherhood responsibilities. Lisa brought along her two beloved cats, her bed and her favourite framed picture. Before this, Lisa had been living in a rented room at 401 Southeast 4th Street in Cape Coral, which she paid around $200 a month for. She had rented the room from Howard Rosenstein for about 8 months, which had helped him to pay off his mortgage. He recalled of Lisa, "She was a real nice girl." In May of 1990, Jan was struggling to find restful sleep for 3 consecutive nights. She kept hearing strange sounds outside her home. The swinging patio gate, the glass sliding door downstairs opening and closing, and the clashing of the vertical blinds. The unsettling noises made Jan believe that somebody might be prowling around her home. One morning, her fear seemed validated when she spotted a man with a hat near her privacy fence, watching her intently as she dealt with her cat on the balcony. As she looked at him, he smiled at her, and it sent shivers down her spine. The lack of rest became so severe that Jan had to call in sick to work on the 9th of May, 1990. That night, Jan planned to spend some time at her boyfriend, Donnie Batista's home. At 11 p.m, she tucked her daughter, Robin, into bed with her cat, while Lisa relaxed in the other bedroom on her king-sized waterbed after a day of unpacking. Jan fell asleep on the sofa at Donnie's home while watching TV and awoke at 4 a.m. She left to get ready for work, but when she returned and tried to open the front door, it wouldn't budge. The doorknob lock, which nobody in the house used, had been engaged, which prevented the door from opening. Jan walked around to the back of the house and discovered that the sliding glass door was open, with the vertical blinds blowing in the breeze. Inside, she found that the kitchen lights were switched on, and photographs of Robin and her older sister Jenny were spread out on an ironing board, removed from their usual display. Jan recollected. I knew right then something bad, terrible, was wrong. She proceeded through the home, but nothing else appeared to be amiss. That was at least until she reached the top of the stairs. The upstairs of the home had been completely ransacked. Her anxiety peaked as she rushed into Robin's bedroom. Her eyes were immediately drawn to Robin. She was on her knees on the floor with her face pushed into the carpet. Her nightgown was pulled up around her neck, and her underwear had been removed. She was bruised and beaten. Jan rushed to her daughter's side and immediately noticed that she was freezing cold and stiff. She knew that Robin was dead, but she began performing CPR while screaming out to Lisa. Lisa failed to make an appearance, and Jan knew in her heart that she was dead in her bedroom as well. As it turned out, both Robin and Lisa had been beaten, suffocated, and then sexually assaulted post-mortem. Jan began to scream at the top of her lungs, alerting her neighbour, Madeline Munch. Those screams were followed by, "My baby, my baby, the fucking neighbours, why didn't they wake up?" As neighbours rushed to the scene, Jan somehow managed to call 911 amidst the chaos. 911, please, there's someone in my house, someone come to my house, I think my daughter's dead. Oh my God, please hurry.
Ma'am, please just calm down with me.
Police arrived at the scene within just minutes, and they immediately cordoned off the crime scene. Jan was in a state of hysteria, begging somebody to cover up Robin's body. She was escorted from the home and was taken to be consoled and interviewed. She said that Robin was a heavy sleeper, so she theorized that the killer had suffocated Lisa before proceeding into Robin's bedroom. They asked whether she had seen anybody suspicious in the lead-up to the murders, and she thought back to that strange man smiling at her just the morning beforehand. The investigation at the home got underway promptly, as forensic experts descended on the scene. As many as 30 detectives swarmed the scene, documenting fingerprints and footprints, and using specialized laser equipment to pick up things that could be missed by the human eye. They immediately observed the same thing that Jan had observed, that the upstairs was ransacked. According to Jan, some items were missing from the home. One item was a square-faced, gold Seiko quartz watch that Lisa had just purchased for her boyfriend Randy. It had an inscription on the back which read, "To Randy, happy birthday, 5/11/90, all my love, Lisa." At the door, the paper that the watch had been wrapped in was left discarded. The killer had also taken off with a yellow gold, single-center stone ring with a small diamond. It belonged to Lisa, and it was an antique. They had also stolen Lisa's driver's license, checkbook, and credit cards. Curiously, the killer had left behind a pair of socks, and it was theorized that he had used these to cover his hands while committing the murders. The investigation led detectives to believe that Lisa was killed first, and then Robin killed second. They believed that while ransacking the home, the killer had found a pornographic magazine and a sex toy that belonged to Lisa. He appeared to read it at the foot of Lisa's bed. He then left the sex toy in Robin's bedroom. In the bathroom, forensic experts came across footprints, which suggested that the killer may have taken a shower. Despite this, the drain contents were not collected. Forensic experts combed the home from top to bottom. They collected evidence in each room, and in Robin's bedroom they came across something sinister. It was a semen stain on her bed covers, as well as a semen stain on her body. While the investigation at the home continued, detectives embarked on thorough door-to-door inquiries, seeking any possible leads from the shocked neighbours. They wanted to know if anybody had seen or heard anything suspicious that night, or even in the days leading up to the murders. Neighbours were horrified about the brutal murder that had taken place in their residential neighbourhood. Some shared with the media that they felt that they had lived in a safe community, and many didn't even lock their cars at night or close their windows. Now, they were thinking twice. Maryam Shani shared that fear with News Press, stating, "That's too close to my house. Way too close. I took my son out of school today because I was afraid that this person would go there." Reports emerged that some suspicious activity had been noticed at the complex. Deborah McGilligutty recounted seeing a suspicious beige and brown Bronco or Blazer parked near the Cornell's unit on the 8th of May, between 4:30 and 6:30 p.m. However, no one had witnessed anything suspicious on the night of the murder, but the neighbourhood was known to be quite loud due to heavy traffic and varying noise levels. Vi Pimper commented, "It's hard to hear anything. It depends on the way the wind blows. Sometimes you can hear a pin drop, or sometimes you can't hear anything." News of the shocking double murder quickly spread throughout Cape Coral, and 12 crisis counsellors from the Lee County School District were dispatched to Tropic Isles Elementary School to support Robin's grieving classmates. Most of them had learned about the tragedy from the media initially, since the school administration hadn't received immediate official confirmation. Once confirmed, however, the school contacted a parent or guardian from each pupil in Robin's class, offering them the option to send their child to school or allow them to stay home for the day. Two counsellors were assigned to each of the school's 6th, 5th grade classrooms. The school also shared their plans to dedicate a pond on the campus to Robin. As the investigation continued, police spokesman Greg Durham emphasised that the process was taking longer than usual, given the department's limited experience with murder cases. Preserving the crime scene diligently was their priority, and he stressed that the reality was far from what people might see in crime dramas such as Miami Vice. Furthermore, the investigation of the crime scene faced challenges due to Lisa's recent move. Many individuals had been helping her move her belongings, resulting in numerous fingerprints and footprints that needed careful examination. Only once all the possible evidence was collected could detectives start piecing together the puzzle of the crime. For 15 long hours, Robin and Lisa's lifeless bodies remained at the home until they could be removed by the medical examiner. Before their removal, however, Jan requested Father Arthur Hannaway of St. Andrew's Catholic Church to perform the last rites for Lisa and Robin. Although religious ceremonies are typically conducted after bodies have been removed from crime scenes, an exception was made. At the medical examiner's office, it was reported that the pathologist couldn't narrow down when Robin and Lisa had been killed. He could only say that it was sometime between 11 p.m. and 4 a.m., which was when Jan was out of the house. The community really bonded together in the wake of the tragedy, and funds were started at Citizens and Southern National Bank and Parkway Federal Savings Bank. The purpose was to help raise funds for Robin and Lisa's upcoming funerals, and to help the families out in any way possible. The first funeral to be held was for Robin on the 16th of May, where the grief-stricken loved ones congregated at St. Andrew's Catholic Church in Cape Coral. Holding hands, they wept as a small child-sized coffin was silently escorted into the church. Reverend Timothy Murphy presided over the service and addressed the mourners with the heartfelt words, "My friends, we are confronted with a tragedy that we cannot understand, and yet we cannot ignore." He acknowledged the haunting impact of the double murder, which left many questioning why such a dreadful event had occurred. Although some believed it to be the will of God, Reverend Murphy expressed his personal conviction the tragedy was not a manifestation of divine will. He solemnly stated, "I don't believe the tragedy is God's will." There were a number of children at the service, too young to fully comprehend exactly what had happened, but old enough to know that their friend was never coming home. Reverend Murphy urged the mourners to rejoice in the memory of Robin's life, and fondly recalled how he had baptized her as an infant. He stated, "However hard we try, we cannot enter the sorrowful world of Robin's family. The pain is only something they can know, but our presence here is our way of saying we're bound in a special friendship, the friendship of faith." Lisa had a private service. Once the funerals concluded, the investigation into the double murder continued. A homicide hotline was established to receive anonymous tips, but the responses were disappointingly scarce. Sergeant Dave Stadelman disclosed that some callers had merely inquired about the case without sharing any leads, making the task of detectives all the more challenging. Detectives were working around the clock on the case 7 days a week. The longer the investigation went on, the more the community were concerned. It's one thing for a single murder to happen, but for a double murder where one victim is a child, the community were left on edge. There was a tremendous fear that whoever had killed Robin and Lisa could strike again at any moment, and nobody felt safe. Cape Coral's mayor touched on that fear by stating, "People are concerned. My first reaction was shock that these things happen, but once you think about it, it doesn't seem to be a trend or something happening in the community. It's an isolated case. I hope they solve it soon." In early June, Jan and her 18-year-old daughter, Jenny, wrote a letter of thanks for the love and support shown to them in the aftermath of the double murder. The letter read in part, "Dear friends, we would like to thank each of you, old friends and new, for the love and support you have offered during this difficult time. The loss of a child is heartbreaking under any circumstances. When an unknown individual takes the life of your child for no apparent reason, it's even more difficult to understand and bear." They wrote that they would never have been able to make it through the tragedy if it wasn't for everybody's support, their kind words, their prayers, and their gestures of kindness. They thanked everybody at the hospital where Jan worked, as well as the school where Robin was a student. They additionally thanked Rainbow Florists for providing flowers for the funerals, and the banks who had collected money to help them cover the costs. The letter went on to thank the detectives working on the case, as well as St. Andrew's Church, where Robin had her funeral. They also thanked Jolly Lou, who they referred to as Robin's other half, her best friend. 1 month had passed since the tragic discovery of Robin and Lisa's lifeless bodies at home. Detectives faced the daunting task of investigating the brutal crime, but remained determined to pursue justice. Police Chief Lynn Rowe acknowledged the complexity of the case, emphasising that criminal investigations were far from simple portrayals seen on television. The painstaking process involved thoroughly examining each piece of evidence collected from the crime scene, but thus far they had not identified any suspects or persons of interest. Chief Rowe appealed to the public for any information, no matter how seemingly insignificant, that could aid in solving the murders. During the door-to-door inquiries, everybody within the 144-unit complex had been interviewed. So had 500 other units in the square mile around the complex, but not a single person could offer any insight into the murders. Just the following week, Cape Coral Hospital put up a reward fund for $10,000 for information that could lead to the arrest and conviction of the killer. The hospital's director, Robert Finkernadel, stated, "We want to do everything we can to help speed up the investigation to a conclusion. This seemed to be a logical action on our part. Unfortunately, the reward did nothing to lure out any information, and the weeks continued to trickle past." In July, detectives shared with the public that they were still waiting for some results from the lab, which was extremely busy at the time. Before the family knew it, it had been 3 months since Robin and Lisa were killed, and the uncertainty meant that they couldn't truly begin the grieving process. In August, Jan expressed her overwhelming desire to see the killer brought to justice. Filled with sorrow and rage, she tearfully pleaded, "I want this person caught, and I want him to get the electric chair. I want him to die for what he did." Her visits to Memorial Garden Cemetery, where Robin was laid to rest, only intensified her anguish. The only way that she could see her daughter was through photographs. Jan also took the opportunity to raise awareness about the still-at-large killer, urging the community to remain vigilant and protect their children. Ken and Donna, Lisa's parents, broke their silence that same month. Donna solemnly commented, "I still think sometimes that this isn't happening. I think we're talking about somebody else most of the time." They shared their belief that Robin and Lisa's killer was going to be caught at some stage, and that they weren't giving up hope just yet. In September, Crime Stop aired an episode focusing on the unsolved murders, featuring a detailed reenactment that revealed previously undisclosed information to the public. The show disclosed that both Robin and Lisa had been subjected to rape and smothering. Additionally, it depicted the man with the hat who Jan had encountered the day before the tragedy. Hopes were high that the TV program would generate fresh leads and tips, but unfortunately, nothing substantial emerged from the tip line. Robin and Lisa's families yearned for closure and justice, but the investigation seemed to stall, leaving them desperate for answers. Towards the end of October, Jan openly expressed her frustration in conversations with local newspapers. She passionately questioned, "I want to know why there's still a child killer on our streets. I want to know why, after 5.5 months, they've only got a quarter of the evidence back from the crime lab. How much longer are we going to have to wait?" In response, detectives assured her that they were working as swiftly as possible, but the lengthy wait for test results from the lab impeded progress. The large volume of items to analyze contributed to the delay, causing further distress to the families. Then on the 30th of November 1990, it would have been Robin's 12th birthday. Her loved ones gathered at Memorial Garden Cemetery to mark the sad event. They released 12 dozen balloons, and these balloons signified something that Robin had written in a poem that she gifted her mother for Mother's Day. It read, "Roses are red, violets are blue. When you see balloons in the sky, you know I love you." They released the balloons into the air and watched on as they silently floated up to the sky and out of sight. Jan wiped a tear from her eye and said, "I hate this. It makes me hate everything. I have good friends. I have good family. And still, I hate everything." She said that they all missed Robin terribly, but knowing that her killer was still out there made it all that much worse. Though the family faced deep discouragement, the subsequent weeks would unexpectedly bring a major development in the case, placing the unsolved murders back into the spotlight once more. On the 7th of December 1990, a man named Kenneth Lamar Smith was charged with 2 counts of sexual battery, 1 count of kidnapping, and 1 count of grand theft auto in an abduction and rape in Fort Myers back on the 6th of December 1989. Smith was suspected in a series of 11 abductions and 9 rapes that took place between November 1989 and February. He had become a prime suspect when his palm print matched a palm print found on the car of a rape victim. Detectives announced that Smith was also being investigated in the double murders of Robin and Lisa. Jam found out about this potential lead via the newspaper, instead of the detectives coming to her direct. Just as quickly as the lead came forward, however, it fizzled out, and detectives couldn't connect Smith to the unsolved case. In March, a southern magnolia was planted at Cape Coral Hospital in honour of Lisa. In front of the tree, a plaque read, "In memory, Lisa D. Story, September 15th, 1957 to May 10th, 1990. You can fly higher than an eagle," which was from the song "Wind Beneath My Wings." Lisa's mother, Donna, attended the planting ceremony, and she said that it was lovely to see how many people cared for her daughter. It was soon enough the one-year anniversary to Robin and Lisa's murder, and it was revealed that detectives were still waiting for evidence to be processed by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Jan was upset with the delay and commented, "I don't think medically or scientifically it takes a year to get a report on something. It's almost a year, and I personally think that's long enough to look for anything. I don't know why we don't know." Lisa's mother, Ruth, agreed, but said that she was keeping her trust in the detectives. Finally, in April, detectives met with officials from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement's crime lab to go through some of the evidence. They had managed to find fingerprints that they believed were from the killer, but unfortunately when they were ran through databases, nothing came back as a match. However, that also wasn't to say that the fingerprints found had even come from the killer. So really, the investigation was just back at square one. Furthermore, a vast majority of the evidence was still waiting to be analysed, including the semen stains. Overwhelmed by grief and despair, Jan decided to move away from Cape Coral, feeling that the place had become a tragic reminder of her daughter's tragic loss and the lingering presence of her killer. She relocated to North Fort Myers but continued to work at the hospital, not far from the scene of the heinous crime that had forever changed her life. Despite the heartache and uncertainty, Jan remained hopeful that justice would one day prevail. In July, detectives said that budget cuts had resulted in delays in testing the evidence found at the crime scene. The workload over at the crime lab was increasing, while the budget did not reflect that increase. The months continued to drag past achingly slow, and on the two-year anniversary, detectives finally decided to reveal some more information publicly. They disclosed to the public for the very first time about the watch that was stolen by the killer. Detectives released a photograph of a similar watch and asked the public to think back if they could recall anybody they knew wearing a similar watch. They said that there was a chance that the killer had scratched off the inscription, but said that marks would have been evident if so. Robin and Lisa's family felt that it was too little too late, with Lisa's father Kenneth commenting, "I'm never sure how much effort they're putting into it." In September, no lucrative information had yet come forward, so Jan decided to take matters into her own hands. She spoke with the media and shared her frustration with the lack of movement in the case. She said that she wanted national publicity in an effort to stir up new leads. Jan said that she was going to send letters each week to various shows, including Unsolved Mysteries, The Oprah Winfrey Show, Geraldo and America's Most Wanted, until she got a response. One of her relatives had already contacted America's Most Wanted, but they were turned down due to the production schedule. Detectives on the case had also contacted Unsolved Mysteries, but they too had also been turned down. Detective Todd Everly said that he had been trying to get national coverage, and claimed that there were still two full-time detectives working on the case. Nevertheless, Jan was still critical, and she even said that investigators weren't following up on leads and tips that she thought would be crucial. In an effort to get more spotlight on the case and get more eyes looking at it, Jan asked the FBI to get involved, but her request was turned down. John finally received a call back from the Sally Jesse Raphael show in January 1993, and it aired the following month. In the show, John heavily criticized the detectives working on the unsolved case. She stated, "I think they should follow through. When they started this investigation, there was probably 10 investigators. All of a sudden, there were 3 investigators in a very short period of time." She described the moment that she found her daughter dead, before ending the segment with a plea. She said that somebody in Florida must have known what happened to Robin and Lisa, and she pleaded with them to come forward. The segment led to 15 phone calls to detectives the day after it aired, but none of them could provide any further insight into the murders. Despite everything that the families were trying, the case only seemed to get colder and colder. They were left wondering if the killer of Robin and Lisa would ever be caught, and whether he still lurked among the community. Time continued to trickle past, and the 3-year anniversary rolled around in May 1993. As the 4th year approached, Lisa's parents, Donna and Kenneth, paid for a billboard ad that was put up along US Highway 41. The billboard featured the picture of the watch that was stolen from the Cornell home. Donna solemnly commented, "I just hope that it can remind somebody of something, that somebody might see it and something will click." Both Donna and Kenneth were now in their 70s, and they desperately wanted to see justice served before they passed away. As the billboard was unveiled, detectives revealed for the first time that lab testing had shown that the killer was a white male who had type O blood. It was also revealed for the first time to the public as well that the killer had stolen Lisa's antique ring. Detective Charlie Garrett, who had since taken on the case, stated, "We have the physical evidence to link this individual to the case. What we need to do is identify him." John, Donna, and Kenneth continued trying to come up with ideas to get the unsolved case to the forefront of everyone's minds. In March, a potential development emerged when Frank Potts was arrested for sexually assaulting an 11-year-old girl. Detectives suspected that he was a serial killer, having been responsible for up to 15 murders from New York to Florida. Detectives in Cape Coral began looking into him as a potential suspect in the murders of Robin and Lisa. But when it was discovered that his blood type was A, he was ruled out. It was disheartening to Robin and Lisa's families, but they were still determined in seeking justice for their daughters. Tragically, in 1995, Lisa's mother, Donna, went to the grave without ever knowing who had killed her daughter. The years continued to drag past, and in 1999, John shared with the media that she wouldn't rest until the killer was caught. She said that she was no longer getting help from Cape Coral Police, and said that she had struggled to even reach them on the phone the majority of the time. She commented, "You'd have to be a totally dysfunctional person in society to believe there's something going on with this case." John revealed for the first time that a bag of evidence had been returned to her a couple of months earlier. Inside this bag of evidence was a set of Toyota car keys, and she had no idea who they belonged to. She wondered if they belonged to the killer, or whether somehow evidence had become mishandled. She also said that the investigation had earlier led to 3 men in Massachusetts, and when detectives went to interview them, one of them broke through a window to flee. John commented, "That was the best lead so far, and they've just dropped it." She said that when she told other detectives outside of Florida about the errors in the investigation, they were all shocked. On another occasion, John had suggested using more modern DNA technology, but the detectives in Cape Coral had no clue what she was talking about. Detectives responded to the criticism and said that they check each lead that come in, but said that they were few and far between. They also said that they had new cases to investigate each day and that they wouldn't comment any further on the investigation. It wouldn't be until 2001 that the significance of that set of Toyota car keys would finally come to light. In June of 2001, a photograph of a key ring with a car key, 2 house keys, and one unidentified key was made public. These keys had been discovered at the crime scene, but detectives had completely overlooked them. They were only discovered when the bag of evidence was handed over to Jan, and she didn't recognise them. Jan had requested a bag of her daughter's jewellery from the evidence collection, and these keys were in the bag. Jan was absolutely horrified to learn that such a massive piece of evidence had simply been overlooked, and it made what little faith she had left in the detectives completely falter. Detective Charlie Garrett said that he wasn't sure why the keys had been overlooked before adding, "We know they didn't belong there. It might tell us who could have had access to the home." While releasing a photograph of the set of keys, Detective Garrett also said that the FBI had compiled a profile of the killer. According to their findings, the suspect was described as a white male with type O blood, possibly residing or working in the Cape Coral area. He likely held an unskilled job that didn't involve direct interactions with the public, and he exhibited a loner personality with few, if any, friends. The killer was noted for being quiet, passive, and possibly living alone, with family, or dependent on somebody else. The profile further suggested that the perpetrator saw himself as physically strong, possibly involved in prowling or burglary. After the murders, he might have pretended to be ill to isolate himself, and could have even left the area in an effort to evade capture. Despite the photograph of the keys in the FBI profile, nobody came forward with any information. In July of 2002, the unsolved case was presented to the VDOC Society, which is an all-volunteer crime-solving group made up of the best of the best, including detectives, attorneys, pathologists, and other experts. Jan was pleased with the development and commented, "I do believe that after 12 years they've exhausted what they can from here." Jan commented how when she used to imagine Robin, she imagined her how she found her. But now when she lay down to sleep at night, she remembered the good times and her daughter's smiling face. The VDOC Society were intrigued by the fact that the killer had read through the pornographic magazine. They speculated that this might have prompted his post-mortem burst of sexual violence, with one of them commenting, "It gives a certain deviant profile. In the minds of some killers, the murder isn't over until they say it's over. I hope the Cape Coral Police will explore this fully." After presenting the case to the VDOC Society, Detective Garrett retired. While Jan understood that he was retiring, she was upset because nobody knew the case like he did. Although the case had faced its own problems, Detective Garrett knew the facts of it like the back of his hand. The unsolved double murder was handed over to Detective Doug Christensen. Finally, in 2004, the case was featured on America's Most Wanted. Tragically, Lisa's father Kenneth passed away that year before the segment aired. Both he and Lisa's mother had gone to the grave without knowing who had brutally murdered their daughter, and they had spent all of their retirement years seeking justice. While the segment on America's Most Wanted did very little in producing leads, it put the case at the forefront of everyone's minds. The following year, Cape Coral Police announced that they were wanting to hire a contracted detective to work around the clock on the case. Ironically, Detective Garrett announced that he was interested in taking the job back. Jan said that she would have loved for Detective Garrett to come back, and stated, "Charlie's always given 200% to the investigation." Unfortunately, however, Detective Garrett ultimately decided against taking on the role, and police struggled to find an appropriate applicant. It wasn't until March of 2006 that a full-time detective took on the role. Detective Fidel Ballin promptly began familiarising himself with the case and put all of the data into a new computer program. This would allow him to compare and contrast data on the murder case. His contract was renewed several times before it was ended in September of 2008 due to budget constraints. It was a massive kick in the gut to Jan, who believed that the case was finally going to be cracked with a new set of eyes on it. She commented, "I'm not so unreasonable that I don't understand the economy, but it saddens me. I know they have put a lot of time and money into this case, and they know now that I'm never going away. In May of 2010, the 20-year anniversary of the double murder rolled around. To mark the event, detectives in Cape Coral released more photographs of the set of keys and the watch in the hopes that it would refresh someone's memory. They also said that they still believed that the case was solvable. After all, they had the killer's DNA. It was just a case of matching that DNA to somebody, and they ran the DNA through the national database every single year. They hoped that one day, the killer would be arrested for another crime, which would mean that his DNA would be on the database. Over the next couple of years, detectives tried everything possible to track down a person of interest. The case was featured on America's Most Wanted again, and detectives even turned to social media. Jan spoke with Cape Coral Police for their YouTube channel.
Not giving up. I'm not going away. I'm not giving up. And thankfully, I've been able to keep the Cape Coral Police Department on board with my promise. I've told them all about my promise. I promised the day I had to say goodbye that for as long as I was alive, I would never stop looking for who hurt them. And like I said, I've managed to establish a relationship and keep the Cape Coral Police on board. And they're still looking as well. We'll just keep doing this as long as, you know, we can reach out and ask people, because I'm convinced in my heart and soul that someone still in this community may have knowledge of who did this crime, and they keep holding back and holding back, and every year I say, it's time, please come forward.
As John said in the interview, she wasn't giving up. That perseverance would pay off in September of 2016, when the case was finally cracked wide open. Jan would come to learn that the killer was hiding in plain sight the entire time. On the 27th of August 2016, 25-year-old Zachary got into an altercation with his father, 54-year-old Joseph Zeiler. They were at their home in Byron Avenue, North Fort Myers, when an argument broke out. This wasn't too far away from where Jan was living after she moved from Cape Coral. Zeiler responded by grabbing an air rifle and shooting his son before fleeing from the home. Zachary's mother Bonnie called emergency services, and Zachary was rushed to hospital, where he needed to undergo emergency surgery. Police arrived at the home and they found Zeiler hiding in his shed with a rifle propped up beside him. According to Zeiler, he shot his son in self-defense because his son was larger than him. In 2009, a law had passed which required felony defendants submit a DNA sample upon their arrest. When Zeiler was arrested, he was ordered to provide his DNA. Astonishingly, it came back as a hit to the DNA found at the crime scene in Cape Coral. Detectives from Cape Coral came to interview Zeiler in jail, and at first he was evidently nervous and evasive as his voice cracked. He said that he had been in Cape Coral around the time of the double murder, but said that he had memory loss from a motorcycle accident. He said that his girlfriend made all of his decisions for him, and that he didn't know his parents' name or how he had gotten to Cape Coral. It was clear that they weren't going to get any kind of confession, but the DNA evidence was enough for him to be connected to the double murder. On the 29th of September, detectives announced that Zeiler had been arrested in connection with Robin and Lisa's murder. Jan was there for the press conference, and through tears she commented, "It was like winning the lottery of justice. Every prayer, every word, everything came full circle." She had been waiting 26 years for this very moment. She had never lost faith and had never lost hope. And now she was ready to see justice finally be served for Robin and Lisa. As it turned out, this wasn't Zeiler's first run-in with law enforcement. Just 2 months after Robin and Lisa were killed, he was arrested after trying to pawn stolen jewellery. he was found guilty of the offense. While behind bars, Zyla wrote letters to his common law wife, Bonnie, including one in which he spoke of a darkness that he had wrestled with. He had said, "There's a good chance I'm going to prison for the rest of my life, because where things crept." In November, a grand jury finally indicted Zyler with two counts of first-degree murder, and he was facing sexual battery and burglary charges as well. The following month, the state attorney's office announced that they would be seeking the death penalty against Zyler if he were convicted of the double murder. He subsequently pleaded not guilty and was expected to go on trial in July of 2022. As the date drew closer, however, it needed to be pushed back after Cape Coral police found two boxes of evidence in storage. The murder trial finally began in May of 2023. During opening statements, prosecutor Stephanie Russell told the jury the DNA on Robin and two items matched Zyler's DNA. Prosecutor Kevin Shirley, on the other hand, said that the investigation was flawed and said that Zyler wasn't a suspect until decades later. He stated, "He was not on their radar. He was not a suspect in this case. Mr. Zyler had no motive to commit this crime." The first prosecution witness was Jan, who tearfully said that she hadn't planned on going to her boyfriend's house that night, but was convinced by Robin and Lisa. She then took the jury through the moment she found her daughter dead.
"When I came into the room and I found her, I immediately touched her and screamed her name, of course, and she was cold. And
at that point, did you recognize that she was dead?"
"I did."
"What did you do next?"
"I started giving her CPR."
"Did you change the position that she was in?"
"I did. I moved her."
"Did you move her to that position that we saw in Exhibit 44?
"Yes, I did."
"So the position you moved her into was then on her back?"
"Yes."
"Did you actually perform CPR?"
"Yes, I did."
What did you notice when you started CPR?
That she had a lot of congestion, like she had really been crying."
"Congestion from where?"
"Her nose, but then when I gave her breath, I could hear her lungs aspirate, and I knew she was dead then."
"What did you do next?"
I actually was doing that while I had 911 coming to help me."
So you made contact with 911?"
"We did."
"Did you stay with Robin until the police arrived?"
"I did."
"Did you ever go into Lisa Story's room?"
"No."
Lisa's boyfriend at the time, Randy Richards, was also called as a prosecution witness.
"How did you learn about her her demise?"
"I got a phone call right before I went to work. In fact, I was on my way out to go to work that morning, and the phone rang, and I picked it up, and Jeannie Leon called and told me."
Who's that?"
"Jeannie Leon and Jerry Leon, that's his wife. They're friends of ours. Jerry was the gentleman that she was with the first time that I ever met Lisa, that we went bowling."
"And you heard what you were told, and it involved that she, I don't want to get into conversation, but the subject was that she had died."
"Yes, sir."
"What'd you do?"
Well, immediately I called her brother, and Michael, and, he confirmed what was going on, and I just kind of lost it and screamed and hit the wall and knocked a hole in the wall and started running through the house. I had a couple of friends that lived with me. They had divorced their wives, and they needed a place to live, and so I started running through the house, and it was still fairly early in the morning, and I was screaming, get up, you know. And
he said that he voluntarily gave DNA samples and fingerprints immediately after the bodies were discovered.
Over the course of the investigation, and that's been a long time, did you stay involved in the investigation with the
police? Yes, sir, very much so.
A regular communication with them?
Yes, sir.
I'm frustrated at times when...
Extremely frustrated sometimes.
Did you assist financially or by doing certain things to help to try to figure out what had happened to Lisa and her...
Yes, sir, I did.
And Robin?
Yes, sir, I did.
For instance?
For instance, I spoke with private investigators. I would chase any lead that I could anywhere. My heart was broken, you know, and I loved her very much. Still do.
Siler's now ex-girlfriend, Bonnie, also testified. Prosecutors played aloud a jailhouse phone call between him and her. In the call, Siler said, "I'm worried about the other thing that we talked about in the past." However, Bonnie claimed that she had no idea what he was referring to. The prosecution then discussed Bonnie and Zyler's sex life, telling the jury that Robin was found in the same position as how Bonnie had described intercourse with Zyler. The DNA evidence against Zyler was overwhelming. His semen was discovered on Robin's bedsheet, and lab technicians testified the chance of the DNA not belonging to him was 1 in 83 quintillion. A hair which matched his was also found on Lisa's body, and his semen was discovered on Robin's body as well. When Zyler took to the witness stand, he said it was impossible for his DNA to have been found at the crime scene.
Where were you on May 9th and 10th of 1990?
I was in Maryland.
And Mr. Zyler, you've heard experts testify in this case that they are convinced that at least one, if not all three, of the sites of semen or of other bodily fluid that were placed on the bedsheet, the pillow, and or the exterior of the young lady's genitalia was your semen. Is that possible?
No, it's not.
The cross-examination of Zyler became heated. The prosecutor revealed to the jury that Zyler had sent John a letter from behind bars.
The address from whom the letter is coming says Joseph Adam Zyler at the top, and then there's more, but that's the first part.
Yes.
And what are the numbers 47492/835775?
That's my ID number followed by my booking number.
At the Lee County Jail?
Yes.
And the address of 2115 MLK Boulevard, Main Jail, Fort Myers, 33901. That's where you're being housed.
Yes.
And that letter was addressed to who, sir?
J.G. Batista and family.
At what? Well, who do you, did you address this envelope?
Yes.
And who was J.G. Batista and family?
Well, I thought it was Jenny Gal Batista.
Oh, so you were trying to send this letter to Robin's sister then?
Yes.
Okay.
No. Yes. I was trying to send it to family, actually. So I guess I was trying to send it to everybody.
The whole Batista family?
Yes.
And in that particular letter, did you profess your innocence by claiming that it was a relative of yours that did this murder?
Yes, I was trying to defend myself because no one would listen to me.
Sir, it calls for a yes or no. Did you, in the letter, profess your innocence or allege your innocence by saying that a relative of yours had done these murders?
Yes.
In the letter, he had tried to blame a relative for the murders. However, in that same letter, he also suggested that his DNA was at the crime scene because he had a sexual encounter with John.
Did you suggest, in addition to that, now, did you tell the people who this letter is addressed to that you slept with Jan Cornell, Janice, and a friend of hers in 1989, and therefore that's why your DNA is in the Courtyards North condominium?
Yes, I thought so, because she didn't wash her sheets.
You know whether or not Miss Cornell washes her sheets?
How I got that is by the information I was given from you was discovery, and I thought that the only way my DNA could have gotten there was me sleeping with Jan Cornell and Leanne Deller.
Did you sleep with Jan Cornell and Miss Deller?
It's possible, because I was here.
Well, now you were here.
I mean, I was here in December of 89. I testified to that earlier. And what I believe happened is I slept with Jan Cornell and Leanne Deller, and they were just too much of a pig not to wash your sheets.
At one stage, Zeiler had an outburst after the prosecutor read aloud another letter that he had sent to Jan.
If you knowingly allow them to convict the wrong man out of spite and vengeance, I will drag this, parentheses, and you, Robin and Lisa, through appeals all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely. I wrote that.
And did you also write on the next line, I'm innocent, I will prove it, no matter how long it takes. Do you really want the rest of your life spent in court?
Yes, I wrote that.
You're threatening, then, Miss Cornell with what you're going to do should she not, what do you want her to do?
Well, she's calling me a rapist and a murderer, so what, I can't write that? I mean, she's calling me a rapist and a murderer, and I'm calling her a pig for not washing her sheets.
At what point in the 33 years has Miss Cornell called you anything?
What do you mean?
At what point
why am I in court today? You're all trying to convince this jury that I somehow left blonde hair and Lisa Stewart's mouth and clutch in Robin Cornell's fist, because that's a piece of paper right here that they're trying to hide from you.
Mr. Zeiler.
I still see the body of 11-year-old Robin Cornell with the hair of her killer.
The jury will step out.
Zeiler pulled out a piece of paper and tried to show it to the jury. The jury were immediately escorted out of the courtroom, and closing arguments were later presented. During these closing arguments, the prosecutor attacked Zeiler's defense.
When we started this trial, I explained to you what the big three were. I've got a new big three. The three defenses of Joseph Zeiler. It wasn't me. It was my kind of sometimes dad or my half-brother. Or was it, I was in Maryland. Couldn't be me. Or, number three, maybe it was, maybe I slept with Jan or some other lady I read about in State's Discovery somewhere, and that's how my semen ended up on an 11-year-old girl who happened to be murdered the night my semen was found.
After deliberating for just 3 hours, the jury returned with a verdict. They found Joseph Zeiler guilty of the murders of Robin Cornell and Lisa Story. The trial then entered its penalty phase, and victim impact statements were presented. Jan tearfully recounted how both families had lived in fear and sadness, before adding that everybody missed both Robin and Lisa. She said that Robin had brought joy to everybody who knew her, and that she didn't know anything but love in her short life. Randy recalled how Lisa was outgoing, loyal, a hard worker, and somebody who was proud of her job. He said that after Lisa was killed, her mother Donna deteriorated rapidly. As he said, Lisa was Donna and Kenneth's baby. In an effort to save Zeiler's life, his defense team called on forensic psychologist Julie Harper. She said that he had struggled with concentration in school, but said that he didn't repeat grades. She further testified that he had grown up in a broken household, and that there was a power imbalance between his mother and father due to their age differences. She referred to his father as his believed father because he wasn't entirely sure whether he was his biological father or not. She stated, "He's uncertain if his father is Uncle Walter or Bob." She told the jury that his believed father had been aggressive towards his mother, and that Zeiler was the victim of intense verbal abuse. The prosecution called their own clinical psychologist, Karim Yamut, who said he found no evidence that Zeiler actually suffered from memory loss, like he claimed. He instead identified a minor cognitive impairment. The prosecution then said that there were four aggravating factors in the case that warranted the death penalty. Those included Zeiler's criminal history, if the murders happened during another felony, the severity of the crime, and whether it was premeditated. The jury deliberated for 5 hours before recommending that Zeiler deserved to die for the double murder. When they announced their decision, Zeiler made no semblance of emotion. Zeiler returned to court on the 26th of June to learn whether or not the judge agreed with the recommendation of a death sentence. He shuffled into court with his wrists shackled and flashed a smile. When he opened his mouth, it could be seen that he had written the words "killer" on his false teeth. Before the judge imposed the sentence, Zeiler called over his defense attorney, Kevin Shirley. As he leaned down to speak to his client, Zeiler flung his elbow up and struck Shirley in the head. Zeiler was immediately tackled to the ground and escorted out of the courtroom.
Oh!
Relax.
I used to box. I've taken a lot better shots than that.
The judge then sentenced Joseph Zeiler to death. Unsolved homicide cases have a haunting impact, leaving families of victims and investigators grappling with unanswered questions for years, even decades. The tragic murders of Robin Cornell and Lisa Story stand as a testament to this enduring agony. Tragically, Lisa's parents both went to the grave without knowing the truth of who killed their daughter. But eventually, perseverance paid off, and the advancement of DNA technology and fresh laws finally cracked the case wide open. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my newest supporters up on Patreon, Amanda, Linda, Amanda, and Melinda. As you all know, Morbidology is a one-woman podcast, so the support up on there seriously goes such a long way, and I genuinely am eternally grateful. If you'd like to support the show up on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. Or alternatively, you can just search for Morbidology on the app or the website. In exchange for your support, I upload ad-free and early release episodes, bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, behind the scenes, and I also send out a handwritten thank you card and some merch. If you'd like to support the show another way, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are a super easy way to support a show that you like, and I genuinely do appreciate the feedback. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.